Welcome to any new people that we have with us tonight. As always, we welcome guests at any meeting of the Ottawa PCS Group. In the chat, there is a link for where you can go to join if you'd like to. It's just $20 a year, but if you want to just join as a guest, you're more than welcome to continue to do so. So tonight's presentation is all about Windows 10 end of life, and I'd like to thank Alan, who is our program chair, for coming up with this presentation. And I think most people here are very familiar with Alan. If you're new to the group, he is on the board of directors and has been a very long-term member of the group. And with that, I don't think we need any other introductions. So, Alan, I will turn it over to you to lead us through your presentation.
Okay. End of life. All right, so I think everybody probably knows by now that if you're running Windows 10 on your computer, and Microsoft has been bugging you for a long time, telling you that Windows 10 is going to reach end of life on October the 14th, which is coming up rather quickly. And basically, that means that after October the 14th, you will not be receiving any more updates for your Windows 10 operating system. That means there'll be no more Patch Tuesday, there'll be no more security updates, and you won't get updated drivers, if any are available for your hardware. Microsoft won't be introducing any new features into Windows 10. They haven't been doing that for quite a while. And if you have been contacting Microsoft directly by phone or email or passenger pigeon or something, then you will not get any further technical support on Windows 10. Now, the October 14th date is kind of interesting because at a Q&A session recently, Chris pointed out that October the 14th is actually International E-Waste Day. And so we're in the situation here where a whole bunch of computers aren't going to be supporting their operating system anymore, and some people are probably going to trash their machine, and it will end up in that great technological landfill. Now, I'm sure it's just a coincidence, and certainly International E-Waste Day has been around for a long time. It's not that somebody's developed it just to give Microsoft a black eye, but it's a very interesting coincidence. Okay, so the question really is, if you're running Windows 10, what do you do next? And as I said, I developed this presentation basically a year ago. It was the first time I gave it. And what I said was there's no need to panic because you had a whole year to think about what you were going to do. Well, it's no longer is it true that you have a whole year, but you do have more than a month. You have pretty well 5 weeks to think about things and decide what is the best way forward for you. And we'll talk about all of the options that you can consider. However, in the meantime, don't panic because nothing really changes. Windows 10 is going to keep continuing security updates, and Patch Tuesday was probably yesterday, I don't know. You'll get them until next October. So it's probably 14th. There's probably another Patch Tuesday in there somewhere. I don't know. It's usually the second Tuesday in the month. Before it actually reaches end of life, before October the 14th, what can you do? Well, one of the things you can do is, if Microsoft's been bugging you to upgrade and your machine is capable of running Windows 11, if Windows 11 is supported, then why wouldn't you just update to Windows 11? In the good old days, you probably updated from Windows 7 or Windows to Windows 10, or maybe XP to Windows 7. And why wouldn't you just update from Windows 10 to Windows 11? And you certainly could keep using Windows 10. I mean, the operating system is going to stop running on October the 14th, but there are some issues if you decide to do that. You can obtain extended support from Microsoft, and we'll talk about the ways that you can do that. You can also buy extended support from at least one third party, or Another option is just to buy a new computer, because you buy a new computer, that new computer will come with Windows 11 already installed, and so now you'll have a bright, shiny, fast, nice new computer with the current operating system ready to go. Now, there is another option, and it's actually the one I favor, and I will talk about this a little bit. And you can also just keep running Windows 10 for Windows things and trade up to Linux and do most of your work on Linux and just use Windows if and when you need to. And maybe you actually don't need to. Maybe you can just move to Linux completely. Anyway, we'll talk a bit about that towards the end. Now, you don't have to take all these statements from me. People in the club know that I'm a fan of Dave Plummer. He's a retired Microsoft engineer, software engineer. He has a YouTube channel called Dave's Garage. And a little while ago, he had this video that Windows 10 is dead. And he basically talked about all the options that you should just think about doing. And one of the interesting things he said was, if you keep using Windows 10 as is, then it's going to be like standing on ice, and the ice is going to crack, and eventually something is going to fall through, and that's probably not going to be so great. But he has a really balanced approach to things, and he tells you all the things that you can and can't do with Windows 10. More recently, he's talked about what you should do before Windows 10 reaches end of life. And basically what he's saying is, make yourself an installation disk for Windows 10, because who knows if Microsoft will maintain the installation software once the thing reaches end of life. And if you happen to need to reinstall Windows, then you would need the installation disk to do a fresh install, for example. So that's another video which is worthwhile using if you're going to continue using Windows 10. And the other person I follow on YouTube quite a bit is Christopher Barnett. He has a YouTube channel called Explaining Computers. And he's a retired university lecturer and has a very interesting deadpan style of delivery. But has a lot of really good information, and I really like his videos. Anyway, this one was 4 months to go, and he's talking about the extended update program, which we'll talk about shortly. one of the interesting slides he had was this slide right here, from a company that basically looks at people logging onto websites and figuring out what operating system they're using. And you can see over the past several months that the Windows 10 share has been dropping and the Windows 11 share has been rising. But in May, it basically flattened out to about, 53-43, with Windows 10 still having the lead. In June, things narrowed because there was a surge in the uptake of Windows 11, but it still means that it's at a 50-50 usage rate. And the estimates are that more than 200 million PCs won't support Windows 10 and could end up in the landfill. However, Christopher Barnett talks about all the different options from doing nothing to running Linux, and we'll go through all of those as we go along. First of all, we have to ask ourselves, can I actually update my computer to Windows 11? And if you look at the Microsoft website, you'll find that there are minimum system requirements, and there's the link on that. And the other thing they say is that Microsoft, we do not recommend installing Windows 11 on a computer that doesn't meet the Windows 11 requirements. So if your computer won't support Windows 11, Microsoft don't recommend that you should try and bypass their tests and install it anyway. However, if you're in that group of people with a fairly new computer, and you found out that you cannot upgrade to Windows 11, pretty easy to do. You just go to the Start menu, go to Settings, Update and Security, Windows Update, and you'll find a necessary link to install Windows 11. And basically what it will do, it will take you to this web page here, where you can download the installation assistant, and then it's just a simple matter of the usual kind of Microsoft installation routine, wizard basically, follow the bouncing ball and convert your machine from 10 to 11. Now the problem is, what about the rest of us? And I include myself here because none of my machines, I've got probably four different computers, and they're all a bit older, I guess. I was horrified to find that my brand new laptop is actually 14 years old, I think. So if you've been looking at Windows Update, you've probably seen this get ready for Windows 11, check the hardware requirements, and you probably clicked on that and you found this thing right here, and it said, well, you know, you need 4 gigabytes of RAM and 64 gig of storage and so on and so forth. But the real problem is you really need to check this guy up here, the PC Health Check app, because that basically looks at your machine and tells you whether it will support Windows 11 or not. So if you go to that link, it will take you to this page, and you'll need to download the app. The app is actually an MSI file, which is an installable, executable file. So you download this and run the MSI file, double click on the MSI file, and it will go into that regular Windows type installation routine. You need to accept the license agreement, is a Microsoft app after all, and then install the Health Check app. So as usual, it goes to a progress bar, and eventually you'll drop out to the end, tell you that the app is installed, and you notice the box checked to open the Health Check when you finish the installation. So you get some information here about backup and updating and battery capacity and all that kind of stuff. We're interested in this bar up here where we can look at Windows 11 and check if our PC meets the system requirements. So we're going to run the check now, which actually runs the Health Check app. And this is the pop-up that I get on my computer. And I'll blow that up so we can see it a bit better. And you can basically see I have two problems. A Trusted Platform Module, a TPM, version 2.0, has to be enabled on the PC. And on my PC, it says TPM not detected. So there is no TPM active on my computer. And the second thing it says is that the processor, the CPU, the main hardware chip on the computer, isn't supported for Windows 11. So I've got a couple of major problems right there. If I go and look at all the results by clicking on this CO, well, I'm not going to do that just yet. I'll do that in a second. First of all, let's find out more about enabling TPMs. So what it tells you here is that this Trusted Platform Module, which is a kind of a special chip that does things related to security, and Windows 11 is going to require this TPM to be available. But most of the computers in the last 5 years either have it installed, activated, or at least they're capable of running a TPM, and you can actually buy these as third-party modules and install them on some computers. Alas, mine not. Again, going back to Dave Plummer, if you want to know more about TPMs, he has a whole video on why he says your old PC is now trash. But again, he points out the reasons that Microsoft decided that they're going to use this enhanced security system on their operating systems going forward. And unfortunately, people like me with old computers, we're collateral damage in the process. The second problem, if you remember, was the chip, the main processor. And we can find out more about that if we click on this link, more about supported CPUs. And this takes us to this system requirements page. And you notice here I've highlighted there's a link for a list of approved CPUs. So that's what we want to do. We want to check out if our CPU is on this list or not. And when we do that, we can see that the processors are based on the type of Windows that we're running, Windows 7, 8, 10, whether it's an AMD or an Intel processor, or whether you have a Qualcomm processor. Most people will have either AMD or Intel. But what I need to do is expand the table and see some more options here. And what I need to do is run down here and figure out what I'm running. And you can see basically there's all kinds of versions of Windows 10. So we need to know what version of Windows we're running and what kind of processor we have on board our computer. And we can do that if we go to the system settings and look at the About menu, which is down here on the bottom left in the taskbar here. And when we pull that up, then so we've gone to Settings, System, About, and we're looking at the Windows specifications. If we scroll down through that list, we'll find two things which are important. We'll find that the processor that I'm using is a Core i7 and the number 4510U. So a Core i7 4510 is important to know. And the second thing I need to know is that I'm running Windows 10 Home and the version is 22H2. So those two numbers, 4510, Core i7, and Windows 22H2 are the things we need to know. And we got that from the settings menu. Right, so now we can go down the list and we can find, all right, we're running Windows 10 and the release is 22H2 and the Core i7 is an Intel processor. So I need to look at this list of supported Intel processors. So I pull that guy up, and you'll find that there's a whole raft of processors which are supported, and they go from less powerful machines up the top to more powerful machines at the bottom. And we need to scroll down. When we scroll down, we find that there's a whole bunch of Core i5s, and there's a whole bunch of Core i7s, and I'm looking for i7 4510. So I need to go further down. And when I go further down, you'll find that my Core i7 goes from 1470 to 5500. So there is no 4510. So that really tells me that my CPU is not, confirms, I guess, that my CPU is not on the supported list for Windows 11. Now, if you want to check that a different way, every time you have a web page, you can use Control and F, which is a shortcut, the keyboard shortcut for the find command. So it pops up this menu, finding the page, type in 4510U, which is a CPU number, and you'll see that I get zero hits on that page. So clearly that CPU really is not there. All right, so it's all lost. Well, we can have a look at, see all the results, I guess. Let's see what else we can find out. And we can find that we do score some things with green check marks. We've got secure boot. We've got at least 4 gig of memory. We've got 16 gig on board. And we've got a 250 gig hard drive, so that's sufficient. However, we're short on the other two things. So we can try and learn more. And when we learn more, it just tells us, well, look, you're out of luck, guy. This PC is not going to run Windows 11. So if you're in that boat, then keep listening. So, what are the options? And you remember that we decided, well, you could just keep using Windows 10. You could get some kind of extended support, either from Microsoft or from a third party. You could shell out some dollars and buy a brand new computer, which will come with Windows 11. or you can trade up to Linux. So the question is, which is best? And the answer is, it depends. It depends on your preferences. And there's all kinds of options there. You just have to decide which is the right thing that will work for you. However, there are some which are probably not such great options. And the first one is just keep using Windows 10 as if nothing had happened. I mean, clearly that's not a very smart thing to do, I don't think. Remember, once end of life comes along, there are not going to be any more security updates. So you no more patches to the operating system. Are you going to get antivirus signatures if you're running Windows Defender as part of the Windows 10 package? Are they going to update Defender as it goes along? It turns out they are, and we'll chat about that in the next slide. However, again, if you were looking for technical support previously, you're not going to get that. There'll be no troubleshooting available. And clearly, without any security updates, your computer is going to be vulnerable to hackers. And I think that hackers are going to spend... Remember, there's 250 million computers that probably can't upgrade to Windows 10. So hackers are going to try really hard to compromise in these machines if they're on the web and take control or use them nefariously. And I don't want mine to be one of those. So this isn't an option for me. Dave Plummer says that issues might arise, that ice-breaking scenario. Hardware and software may not be supported forever. Things may change, and your operating system isn't going to be updated to accommodate those changes. And because of that, system performance may decline over time as well. Going back to Defender, if you look at this blog post, you'll find that Microsoft have indicated that they will provide updates for Defender through October 2028. So certainly antivirus scanners are not really an issue for people who keep using Windows 10. Harvey gave me a heads up on this, a long-term servicing channel option. I had read about this previously and kind of discounted it. But it is available, so let's just talk about it briefly. LTSC is an enterprise level product. It's really meant for, it's a special version of Windows, which is meant for businesses that don't want the operating system changing every 5 minutes. And they want stability. Think of machines that are running ATMs. Now, you don't want those to blue screen every 5 minutes. So you want a stable version of Windows. The LTSC version is going to get security updates basically through 2032, depending on what variant you have. However, if you're running Windows 10, you need a valid license to activate the LTSC version. And this particular make use of post suggests that you can get keys, activation keys, through established resellers online in the region $20 to $30. However, it's not all plain sailing. It appears that you have to do a clean install of this LTSC version if you're going to run that. And typically that means that while you can keep your settings, maybe you're probably going to have to reinstall a whole pile of apps. Keep your settings and your personal data files, documents and pictures, that kind of thing. But if you've got apps that you've installed outside of Windows, then you're probably going to have to reinstall those. If you do an upgrade, the website says that you have to edit the registry, and that's not fun for a lot of different people. And some new software actually doesn't run on older versions of Windows, so that could be an issue depending on what programs you use. And if you've got Microsoft Store apps, then you may have to install some system software. Microsoft Store, the app itself, doesn't come with the LTSC version. So if you want to run Store, then you have to install that app. My big problem is, are these licenses, which you buy for cheap from a third party online, can you trust that that's a good thing to do? For me, I don't know. And that really isn't a valid option as far as I'm concerned. Right, the second thing you could do, second major thing you could do, is basically just install Windows 11 anyway on your existing computer. And it's not supported, but there are certainly lots of ways on the web that will tell you how to install Windows 11 on a machine where it's actually not supported. But bear in mind again, Microsoft don't recommend doing that. So again, you've got that issue of, if you do that anyway, are you going to get security updates for Windows 11? Or is Microsoft going to know that's what you've done and cut you off? And the same thing with antivirus. You definitely won't get any technical support from Microsoft, I'm sure. And you've got that same problem that Dave Plummer pointed out, that you know, you're running an operating system that's not recommended on a computer where it's not supported, and are you going to run into various compatibility issues? So again, for me, that's another unknown, and I'm not actually prepared to go with. One of the things you can do is obtain the extended security updates. There is a specific program available from Microsoft. So you have to be running the latest feature release of Windows 10, but if you've been not using Windows Update, then you will be running version 22.h2, which is the last feature release of Windows 10. So that is the up-to-date version. The ESU program only gives you security updates. You're not going to see any new features in the operating system. If bugs arise, they won't be fixed. You still won't get any technical support. And it says that when they first released it, that enrollment was going to be closer to the end of support in 2025. And while there's a program for organizations, enterprises, there's a special program for consumers. And the thing is, it's only a one-year option. And originally, it was available for $30 US. However, now they've got some extended, some different options, a couple of free ones. But bear in mind, the ESU program is only going to extend the life of Windows 10 at this limited basis for 1 year. So in October 2026, you're going to be in the same boat that you are right now, looking, what do I do when Windows 10 reaches the real end of life, unless they change their mind again. Right, so there are two new options, fairly new options, one is you can synchronize your PC settings to Microsoft Cloud. Now, to do this, you have to have a Microsoft account. You have to log in with a Microsoft account and then synchronize your settings to Microsoft Cloud server. Well, the other thing you can do is to redeem 1,000 Microsoft reward points. And the third one is still that $30 US. Now, the ESU program, as I said, it's only going to be good to October 2026. But Chris pointed out that you actually, if you enroll in the program, you actually get 10 licenses. So for me, who's got maybe four computers running Windows 10, I can enroll once for the ESU program, and I can apply the extended support update program to all of my machines. And this was supposed to be coming online in mid-August, but we'll talk about that in a second. There's a more recent video from Chris Barnett on setting up the ESU program. And if you're concerned about sharing information with Microsoft, synchronizing those settings, for example, with the Microsoft Cloud, Chris points out here that you actually just have to log in with a Microsoft account, share your settings only. You don't have to share any data files, just the operating system settings. And then once you're enrolled in the program, you can log out of the Microsoft account and log back in with your regular local account, and you will find that you are still enrolled in the program. And so if you're interested in the ESU program, this is a good video to watch. Christopher Barnett is a Windows insider, and they got the inside track on trying out the ESU program before it went to general release. And now we talked about the synchronizing your settings, but you can also spend these points. And you may not realize that you have points. I actually went on, I did a search and found out, and went to this rewards.bing.com site. Again, you need a Microsoft account to log on to this website. And when you log on, it tells you how many points you have in the bank. And I was amazed to find out I had 800 points, and I didn't even know I was enrolled in any kind of program. I think what's happened here is I was using Bing, the search engine, as an image search engine. So presumably when I've been searching, I've been collecting reward points for being a good boy. So I've got 800 points, but remember I need 1,000 to get into this thing for free if I don't want to synchronize my settings. So how do I do that? Well, we scroll down the page and we find some kind of ways to get more reward points. And for example, we could look on Bing here to find things to buy, and that would give us 10 points. If we wanted to go out to a restaurant, we could search for a restaurant. That would give us 20 points, and so on and so forth. We can get points in a number of different ways. There's all kinds of ways if you scroll through that website. What I found that was interesting, at the time I was looking at this thing, it said, if I was to download the Bing app, the search app, on a smart device, I could claim 500 points as a new user of the Bing app. So I thought that was good. However, it's not quite that straightforward, but it's close enough. You have to download and install the Bing app onto your, in my case, my smartphone or tablet. You have to sign into this app, again, with a Microsoft account, so you still need that Microsoft account. And then the next thing you have to do is you have to use the app. And all you have to do is complete 2 searches using the app within a 14-day period. So that's not terribly onerous. And it says once you do that, you'll get 500 points automatically added to that rewards account. So sure enough, I did the searches, and a few days later, my 800 points magically changed to 1,300. So now I'm good to use the reward points once I get to that enroll program. Now, this is the interesting point in terms of the ESU program. It actually started in July, and they've been rolling it out slowly in waves, as they say. However, some of the press say there's a huge chunk of users who are yet to gain access, and a chaotic rollout is frustrating millions. Right, so be interesting to know, if you want to add in the chat here, has anybody actually enrolled in this program without being a Windows insider? Just as a regular user, you've actually had the pop-up in the settings menu to say that the enrollment program is available, and you clicked on it and enrolled. What Microsoft do say, apparently, is that all eligible users, everybody who's using Windows 10 right now, will be able to enroll before the end of life, before October 14th. So if you haven't seen it, and I haven't seen it yet, it's supposed to be coming. So stand by. all right, so the other way to get the third-party, the other way to get security patches rather than the extended support program is to obtain them from a third party. And there's a company called ZeroPatch, which basically it's going to have an agent running, a program running in the background on your computer. And what it's going to do is look for micro patches which are available from the ZeroPatch server. And the ZeroPatch people, the developers, are going to be finding vulnerabilities in Windows and fixing them with these patches, and then the agent will download them and install them. Now to do that, again, you have to have the latest version of Windows 10, 22H2, And the program is supposed to again be available in October of this year. However, this one is not free and it's not a one-time option. It's a subscription service. It's €24.95 every year that they offer the program. And at the time I did the slide, that was about $37 Canadian. So it's a $37 Canadian per year to get these patches from Zero Patch. Now, again, my question here is, how reliable are these patches going to be? And how do I think that a company that doesn't have access to Microsoft's proprietary software can develop patches for the operating system? And apparently there are reviews out there which say that they can do this kind of stuff. But again, it's a $37 option to find out, I guess, and how reliable it's going to be. Again, for me, this is kind of another one of those unknown options. All right, so another option is just to buy a new computer. So any computer you buy, a brand new computer, is likely to have Windows 11 installed by default. And if it has Windows 10, then I wouldn't be buying it. No point. The downside, of course, is that you have to buy a new computer and you have to shell out a whole pile of money typically to buy the latest and greatest hardware. It's conceivable that some of your old programs may not run on Windows 11. Highly unlikely, I think. Most things probably are backwards compatible. However, the big problem as far as I'm concerned, and especially in my situation with four different computers, I've got perfectly good hardware. It's running just fine. Why would I basically buy a brand new computer and what am I going to do with the old one? Throw it away? Send it to e-waste? To me, that's horrendous. I just can't imagine all these millions of computers going to either recycling or even worse, to landfill. But I said there's another option, and the other option is everybody in the club's heard me talk about this ad nauseum, I think, but one more time, it's the end of life, and this is a great opportunity if you're at all interested in Linux to essentially, as I say, trade up to Linux. So what about Linux? Well, people will tell you it's only for geeks. You have to be a hardcore computer nerd, or you can't possibly run Linux. That certainly is not true. Linux is hard to learn. Well, it isn't. If you choose the right distro, it turns out using Linux is very like using Windows. Installing Linux is very much like installing Windows. One of the other myths from the good old days was you have to use the command line. No, you don't. Most things these days, you will use a graphical user interface, just like Windows. You have icons to click on and menus and so forth. And the applications that you use are different. Well, that's true. Some are, some are different, but they work just as well. In my view, they work as well or better than some of the Windows software that I use. Some applications are actually the same because the developers produce cross-platform versions of their software. So, for example, I run LibreOffice, LibreOffice Writer, LibreOffice Calc, Impress. I run that on Linux, but I run the same software on Windows. Now, they're not exactly the same. There are some minor differences in the programs. They are running on different hardware, after all, different platforms, anyway. But basically, it's the same software, and it's very easy to use because I use it on both systems. And then finally, a lot of Windows programs, I say some, actually a lot of Windows programs will actually run on Linux. Now, you have to install some special software to make it do that, but again, that's not very hard, and we'll take a quick look at how to do that, too. For those of you who don't know what Linux is, Linux is a free open source, as opposed to closed source like Microsoft. It's an open source operating system. So there's a whole development community that are looking at the source of this program and fixing bugs and creating new features and generally providing new releases on an ongoing basis. It comes bundled with a whole bunch of applications, and you know, that kind of scares people because you think of the Windows machines that come with all kinds of junk applications that you don't want, you never use, and they take up disk space, and if you're like me, you just go and uninstall them all away and free up the disk space. Linux is different. It comes with applications, but these applications are actually really useful. So you get, for example, you get the LibreOffice Office Suite. You get software for doing graphics, software for audio-visual applications, a whole raft of stuff which is good, and there's all kinds of other things that you can install if you want to. I said it's just as easy to install and use as is Windows, but it is a different operating system. It's a different environment. So there's a learning curve. But again, if you get the right distro, the desktop looks very much like Windows. And one of the neat things is that you can install Linux alongside Windows and have it in dual boot mode. So when you power up the machine, you actually get a boot menu and it says, do you want to run Linux or do you want to run Windows? So for me, you have the best of both worlds here. So by default, normally you will run Linux by default. So my preference is going to be doing that. So I'll be running Linux for most of my usage for normal things. And for a lot of people, the applications that came with the distro might be just sufficient for your needs, because you get a broad spectrum of programs that do all kinds of different things. So you may not need anything else. And I did say that some Windows programs can run on the Linux, and I actually have one piece of software for which there is no Linux version, and it will not install and run on the Linux. So if I want to run that program, it's a really niche product, probably only used by a few hundred people across North America, so the developers are not going to produce a Linux version for it. If I want to keep running that program, I'm going to have to run Windows. So my preference is going to be run my machine dual boot, which I've been doing for the last 10 years or more, probably nearer 20 years. And I run my computer dual boot. I'll run Linux most of the time. And then when I need to use Windows, then I'll just exit from Linux and boot into Windows to run my Windows application. All right. Chris hasn't been bugging me, so I'm sure there aren't any really desperately need-to-know questions.
No, I am monitoring the chat, and nothing has been coming up yet.
Okay, good man. All right, so how would we go about trying out Linux? We need to download a Linux distribution, a so-called distro, and I'm going to suggest using Linux Mint. Because this is a very popular Linux distro. There's lots of information available on how to use it, and it's very Windows-like. So you download the Mint as an ISO file. You create a bootable USB, typically, or a DVD if you have an optical drive only. You boot the computer into Linux using this bootable USB. And the reason for doing that is you can actually check whether Linux is going to run on your computer by checking the hardware compatibility. And once you've loaded Linux, then it's a full-blown version of Linux. All the applications are available to you running from the USB drive. So you can check out the hardware, you can check out some of the applications, you can see if the Linux is going to work for you. At least at the cursory level. And then once you decide, yes, everything looks as though it's going to work, then you can install Linux. And again, I recommend dual booted with Windows, so you can always go back to Windows if Linux blows up on you or you can't figure out how to do something and you need to do it like right now. So you still have the opportunity to get into Windows when you need to. And to do that, you use this boot menu called Grub, which we'll talk about shortly. And then if you need to install Windows programs, once you've installed Linux, then you use a program called Wine, or a different version of that called Play on Linux, which I'll mention briefly. And that will let you run some Windows programs in your Linux desktop. And certainly you can do that. Here's my Linux desktop. You can see that it's got a wallpaper. It's basically a black wallpaper. But it's got lots of icons, just like Windows. It's got a taskbar along the bottom there. For some unknown reason, Linux users, Linux and Unix call this a panel. This taskbar down the bottom here is the Linux panel. But it has icons, it has a start menu, and a date and time, and all that kind of good stuff. And you may see that I've got an icon for Microsoft Word on my Linux desktop. And here you can probably see that I've got a Microsoft Word document running in Word in Linux. And this is actually a newsletter article. It's got titles which are bold-faced and centered. It's got paragraphs of text. It's got an image, and so on and so forth. So it's Microsoft Word at its finest, running in Linux. All right. So how do we go through the details of how to run Linux on a live USB? I'm a huge fan of having detailed instructions. So on my Linux North blog post, I have this thing called tips. And one of the tips is how to run Linux Mint from a live USB. And this is highly detailed text and graphics, step-by-step instruction on how to do everything. So there's no excuses for not being able to run Linux from this live USB. Four things you need. You have to download the ISO file. And again, I suggest Linux Mint. And I suggest the Cinnamon Edition, because that's the one that's most like Windows. My slide here had 22, but the latest version is actually 22.2, which is called Zara. So you download the ISO file. You need a USB flash drive if you're going to make a live USB. It has to be 4 gigabytes or larger, and it needs to be empty, or if there are files on it, then you must allow them to be overwritten, because when you flash the ISO file to create the flash drive, then anything on that drive will be lost. You need some software to burn the ISO file to the USB drive. Balina Etcher is one of the programs you can use to do that. There are several others, but Balina Etcher is actually really simple. And finally, once you've got your bootable USB, you need to know how to boot the computer from it. And sometimes that's not terribly obvious. But Mr. Google is your friend here. Go and search for how do I boot my computer from the USB, and he'll no doubt be able to tell you. So here's the Linux Mint website, linuxmint.com. And again, the latest release is 22.2. And just hit the download button here. That will get you the default Cinnamon Edition 64-bit ISO file. Once you download that ISO file, then you'll go and get Balina Etcher. That's a portable application, so you just download the file and double-click on it, and it runs. You don't have to install it. Three-step process. You click on this button to select the ISO file that you just downloaded, where the Linux distro is on the ISO file. You then click this button to select the target, in other words, the USB drive that you're going to create as a live USB. And then once you've selected the source and you've selected the target, you hit flash, and Balina Etcher will do all the magic and write the software to the USB drive. Here's a query to some kind of search engine. How do I boot a Dell Inspiron 15 from the USB? The answer is press F12 after the Dell logo comes up, and you'll get a boot menu. And the boot menu says, do you want to go from the hard drive? Do you want to do it for the USB drive? And you choose USB drive, and the computer will whir and steam will come out of the top, but eventually you'll get to this menu, which is a grid menu. This is the grand unified bootloader menu, which Linux users know and love as GRUB, the GRUB menu. As you'll see, the default option here is to start Linux Mint, the Cinnamon edition. The asterisk tells you this is the default. Just hit return or wait for 10 seconds and the thing will boot. So now you're booting from the USB. So you have to be patient because the boot process, we're coming from the USB, and if you're used to booting from a solid state drive, for example, which are lightning fast, USB drives are much slower. So it takes a while for the computer to read everything and install everything in memory. And you get some black screens, and occasionally you see this green and white logo right here. And eventually, I say, the Linux desktop will load in all its splendor. And here it is in all its splendor. I said that facetiously, but turns out Windows looks very much like that when you do a fresh install. Anyway, here it is in all its splendor. I mentioned the start menu down the bottom here. If you click on the start menu, you get a whole bunch of things that you can play with. So if you run in the live USB, then you can check out some of the software by doing this. However, let's pretend that we've gone through that process. We spent, I don't know, a couple of hours maybe playing around with all the software. And now we're ready. Okay, we're going to install this on our machine. So we look hard at the screen here in the top left-hand corner, and we find this icon which says install Linux Mint. And that's very tempting. We could probably double-click on that. And if we double-click on that, we'll get an installation wizard. And a lot of the, a number of screens, of course, a lot of the inputs that you need are pretty obvious. For example, the first screen here says basically what language you want to use, and the option is English. So unless you want something else, you just press next or continue, whatever the button is at the bottom right, and off you go. So that's a straightforward input to get to the next screen and further down the process. Some of the screens may not be quite so obvious, and we'll talk about those just briefly. However, again, if you really need to know in detail how to do a dual boot installation, I've got another post on my Linux North blog which tells you exactly chapter and verse, text and screen captures, step by step, how to go through this wizard and install the software on your computer. So one of the screens that you'll come across early on in the process is, do you want to connect to a network? And it will show you all the networks that are available. And you do want to connect to it for two reasons. One reason is that you will get updates as you install the program, if it can access the internet. And the second thing is, when you give it the password for your router, your Wi-Fi network, then Linux remembers the password. So next time you boot into Linux, it will load the network automatically. So you don't have to connect to the network every time you power on your machine. So it's just like Windows, where you run Windows, and once you've set up the network, then it connects to the internet automatically. You can run the browser. Well, Linux works exactly the same once you've given it the password for the router right here. This screen is maybe not so user-friendly. It basically says, do you want to unmount partitions that are in use? And it's found a disk that has got mounted partitions. And the disk is /DEB, a device, and it's the disk number SDC. Now, there are three disks on my machine that this is running on. SDA is the solid-state drive, the main hard drive. SDB is an SD card, which I use for real-time backup systems. And SDC is the USB drive that I just plugged in to do the installation of Linux. So it's telling me that I've got mounted partitions on the live USB drive, and I could be in danger of creating or deleting them or resizing them. if I don't do something. Well, I'm not going to do anything on this USB drive, so I actually don't care. It actually doesn't matter whether you say no or yes to this prompt. Either of them gets you to the same place. So say yes, let's unmount it. Why not? Who cares? This one is actually important, but the default is what you want. Right? It's asking, where do you want me to install Linux on your hard drive? Remember, we're installing Linux on the hard drive now. And what you don't want to do is change the option and do the, well, what I don't want to do, and what I don't recommend you users doing, you don't want to erase the disk and use all of the drive space to install Linux Mint. Because if you erase the disk and install Linux everywhere, then you've just blown away your Windows installation. What I want to do is this one right here, the default, install Linux Mint alongside Windows. So I'm going to have both operating systems on the drive. But clearly, we have to make room on the drive because typically Windows is using the whole of the hard drive, apart from recovery partitions and that kind of stuff. Windows is using most of the hard drive for itself and for your data. So we need to create some space. But the installer takes care of that for us. We don't have to worry about that. If you take a look here, we're using a 250 gig solid-state drive. Windows, the NTFS partition right here, is using 175 gig of used space. So roughly, we've got, let's say, 80 gigabytes of free space. We've got 80 gigabytes of space which isn't being used by programs or data or operating system at the moment. It's available space. So what the installer has done here, it said, all right, you've got 80 gig, so I'm going to shrink the Windows partition by about 40 gig down to 209, and I'm going to give you about 40 gig, actually 38, for the installation of Linux Mint. And, you know, when I first did this, I didn't know any better, so I just accepted whatever the option was, and usually that's the right thing to do. When in doubt, accept the default. If you want to change it, then you can shrink the Windows partition by dragging this divider to the left, or you can shrink the amount that's going to be used by Linux by moving the divider to the right. If you don't know what you're doing, then my advice is just use the default and do what it says. 38 gig for Linux and some data files is tons of space, believe me. I think Linux only needs about 16 by itself. Right. The next screen says, where are you? Now, it shows you a map and it wants to know where you are, but it really doesn't want to know where you are. What it really wants to know is, what time zone are you in? And you can probably see here that the shaded area here is the Eastern time zone. And it's found that we're somewhere near Toronto. That's basically where my ISP server is, so I think that's why it thinks I'm in Toronto. Don't bother trying to find Ottawa, because there is no entry for Ottawa. You can't overtype. It just wants to know Eastern time. So just accept Eastern time, and off we go. This is where you get to actually do some inputting. And it really, again, you can input anything you want here almost. It needs a name, you know, your name, whatever you want, you can put in that box. It will suggest the computer's name, but again, you can edit the entry here, and I've just decided to make it i7 Inspira. You do need to have a username and a password. And the only constraint here is that the username must begin with a lowercase letter. And if you don't, if you try put capital J John, then it will complain and won't let you carry on. So you just remember that, yeah, it will tell you you have to have a lowercase letter. But you can use anything you want. I use Toaster. And the reason for that is I had a friend who said computers should be just like toasters. You should plug them into the wall and they should just work. And I always argue that that's exactly how computers do work. You plug them into the wall and they just work. but we all know it's a bit more complicated than that. But in memoriam, I decided that my username is Toaster, and I gave it a password. And I left these two things as a default. I don't log in automatically, so it does ask me for, it remembers the username, it asks me for a password. I'm happy to type in my password when I log in, so I have to require my password to log in. And personally, I don't encrypt my home folder. I just use a third-party app to encrypt just the files or folders I need. I don't encrypt the whole hard drive. Just my personal preference. But those are the defaults. All right, so off you go. You get a whole bunch of screens which advertise what Linux can do for you. And eventually it will tell you, installation is finished, now complete. You can either carry on testing using the USB drive, or you can hit this restart now. So we restart now, the machine powers up, and now we get into the real grub menu. So again, by default now, it's going to go to Linux Mint, but look down here, if I scroll down with the arrow keys, I can get down to Windows Boot Manager, and that will boot into Windows instead of Linux. So you have 10 seconds when the boot menu comes up. You can either wait the 10 seconds and it will boot into Linux, or you can hit return anytime and it will boot into Linux, or you can use the arrow keys to go down to Windows and boot into Windows. Right, so let's just take a quick look at Linux now we've got it installed on our computer. Remember I said you hit this start menu button here in the bottom left-hand corner on the panel, the taskbar, and it pops up this menu, and you got a whole bunch of different things. You got a bunch of accessory programs. You got graphics, internet applications, Office, audio and video, and administration and preferences, and so on and so forth. So basically, the main menu is a bit like the old Windows 7. Down on the left-hand side here, you've got a bunch of favorites, so one click will launch those. This is a list of those categories. And once you hit a category, like here I've hit Office, it pops up all the applications which are loaded in that category. So, for example, you've got a calendar option. You've got a library, which is essentially recent files. And then you've got LibreOffice, and you've got the writer module, which is like Word, Calc, which is like Excel, and Impress, which is like PowerPoint. And you've also got LibreOffice Draw, which is a drawing package, which Microsoft Office doesn't have an equivalent for. If we were to run Writer by clicking on this option right here, you can see this time I've brought up LibreOffice Writer, but I'm still running that same doc file, that newsletter article, and you can see it looks very similar. It's got titles which are bold-faced and centered. It's got text in paragraph. Here's my graphic, which is centered. It's got a ribbon-type menu, just like Microsoft Word, essentially. Now, clearly the menus are going to be a bit different, but it's pretty obvious, you know, here's open, here's save, and here's a convert to a PDF file, here's the printer icon. You'll very easily learn how to use Writer if you know how to use Microsoft Word. So that's what I meant by some of the applications are different, and some of them are same on different platforms. That's an example of both, essentially. Here's the internet menu. You may have heard of the Firefox web browser rather than Edge. You won't get Microsoft Edge by default in a Linux distribution, typically. Linux Mint comes with Firefox, just another web browser, all kinds of them on the internet. And you get an email client, for example, the Thunderbird email client. Now, again, this is an example of a program that's available on all kinds of platforms. I run Thunderbird on Linux, I run Thunderbird in Windows, and I run Thunderbird on my Android phone. So I'm using basically the same software, different versions of it, on three different platforms. One of the system applications is the Update Manager. And Linux has a completely different outlook on how to do updates as opposed to Windows. The one thing I hate about Windows is the way it forces updates on you, basically whether you want them or not. And sometimes, in the good old days, you used to get them when you didn't want them, and it used to do it at very inconvenient times. But now you can kind of tailor the system a bit to try and stop it doing that. For example, I tell Windows that I'm running on a metered connection, so I have to pay for my internet. Now, that's not true. I have unlimited internet, but because it thinks I have to pay, it won't actually do updates all the time. I can pick and choose when I want to do them. The nice thing about Linux is that's exactly what you do. Remember that panel, the taskbar, at the right-hand end, you see the shield menu, which is the update manager. When you see the orange dot, you know that updates are available. But now, whether you want to do them or not is your control. You decide when you want to run the updates, and you actually can decide which updates you want to install, which is interesting. I don't do it, but you could do it. There are three different kinds of updates. You get security patches, you get updates to the kernel itself, and you get updates to install software. And they all have different icons on the shield. Typically, my recommendation is if the update manager is providing you with updates, then just apply them all. I wouldn't know which ones are good and which ones are bad. None of them should be bad. So typically, I just install them all. So for example, here's a list of the apps, a list of the updates. You see there's the shield icon, security patch, a kernel update right here to the kernel, and software updates to various applications. And this is kind of unusual. You see I've got 104 updates and almost a gigabyte of software to download. And this is because this is the first time I've run the update program after installing Linux. So the live USB I'm using is out of date, and it has to download a whole bunch of stuff to bring everything up to date. When I say install the updates right here, it says, no, you've got a kernel update here, and that's going to require even more packages to be installed. So again, just say, okay, just install everything. You're recommending it, off you go. This is more typical. On a typical day or two, I will see a couple of updates maybe, maybe just a few megabytes to download. I tell it to install the updates. 17 seconds later, my system is up to date and ready to go. There are various ways to install software. There's a software. Software in Linux is different from Windows. In Windows, you typically have to run around the internet trying to find packages which might be useful to you and which are safe to install. In Linux, the software is curated, so the developers maintain secure packages on online repositories, basically websites, essentially, but accessed by the software manager. And it's a kind of user-friendly interface, GUI. It's the easiest way to do things if the package you want is available on the software manager, and there are lots of packages available. If it isn't, then typically the developer may provide a Debian software package file, a deb file. This is a special kind of archive. Think about zips. Well, the equivalent of zip in Linux is a tar file, an archive file. And this is a special file where it's got everything you need to install the software program. And the final thing, which sometimes you have to use, if there's no deb package available, then the developer may give you instructions, actually commands, which you enter into a command line. So you need to open the terminal, which is like the Windows command or PowerShell window. You have a terminal and you enter commands, and the developer will tell you exactly which commands to enter, and you can just copy and paste them in the order that he tells you, and usually it works just fine. But in those favorites, this WAPL thing right here is a software manager. If you run that, you find that there's a whole bunch of ways to download software. Sometimes you'll see things on these suggested panels here, these featured applications. And for example, they're featuring VLC, which is a audiovisual player. And if you've used Windows, you've probably used VLC, because it's probably the most popular audiovisual program that's out there for Windows. This is cross-platform, so this is installed in the Linux version. And if you went down to the sound and video category, you would undoubtedly find a whole bunch of programs, one of which would be VLC. Or you can go up to the search bar here. If you know what you're looking for, you can just type VLC and it will load the package. It will tell you something about it down here, the details. And you have this installation button right here. So you just say install. And again, you may have to, there may be dependencies, there may be other packages required for the installation. So again, just say accept those, just continue. And it installs the package, and you can launch it using this button. And when you need, if you decide you really don't like the package, you can come back into Software Manager, and you have this remove option. You just click on that, and the Software Manager will uninstall the program for you. So installation, uninstallation, very easy using the Software Manager. And you can see here that in the sound and video category, the installer has installed a menu item, so we can click on VLC Media Player and run that Linux version. And here we are running an MA4 file. And here you can see Chris talking away. You can hear him, can't you? This is one of our Q&A session audio recordings. And so we're running an audio file on Linux using VLC. So lots of Linux software available, but what if you happen to have a Windows program that you really want? And I talked about Wine, and Linux and Unix people, they love their acronyms, and Wine is an acronym. It stands for Wine is not an emulator. So it doesn't emulate hardware and software systems directly. What it does is it acts as a translation layer. They call it a compatibility layer. So it looks for Windows system calls and library functions. So the developers have special software that will run .exe files on Windows, and they will look for system calls, library function calls. And when they see those, they know they have to translate those into Linux-type software. They have to use POSIX equivalents. That's the Unix Linux system call software. So all that's done by the developers. We don't need to worry about that. We can either just install Wine, or if we want a GUI, a graphical user interface for Wine, a lot of programs will run under Play on Linux. So this is a program, I don't know whether it's in the Software Manager, but you can certainly download it and install it from the Play on Linux website. And when you look for something like I'm interested in, I want to install Microsoft Office as well as Writer, mainly because Impress, the PowerPoint equivalent, isn't 100% compatible with Microsoft PowerPoint. So when I'm doing PowerPoint slides, I really want a version of PowerPoint to run. As it turned out, one of the versions I had at the time was Office 2010. And that is available to load through Play on Linux. Now, it's not a free lunch. You don't get a free version of Microsoft Office. You have to have your own software. And with your own software, you have to have the activation key, the activation code, the product key, that huge long string of stuff. And as you install Office in Play on Linux, it will ask you, the installer will ask you to, it's a Windows installer, so it asks you for the activation key, so you need to do that. And eventually, when you go through all the hoops, follow all the prompts, it will tell you that 2010 has been installed successfully. And sure enough, if we look at the desktop, the installer has installed a whole bunch of Microsoft applications, including Word and Excel and PowerPoint. So let's say we want to run PowerPoint here. And now, again, here we are in Linux. Here's the Linux desktop, the icons, the panel, And now you can see I'm running Microsoft PowerPoint in Linux, and I'm running a PPTX file. And this is one of our Q&A session decks from last November. So clearly, you can run Linux, you can run Linux programs, you can get new programs, you can run Windows programs. You can't run every Windows program, so having dual boot is a really good idea if you need to run a Windows program that won't run on Linux, but lots of Windows programs do. So let's summarize what we've talked about. We know that Windows 10 is going to reach end of life in just 5 weeks on October the 14th. Everything works fine. We get security patches, etc., until we reach end of life. But then afterwards, we have a problem. So we've talked about all the various options. If your machine supports Windows 11 or vice versa, if Windows 11 supports your computer, then why would you not just update to Windows 11 and life will carry on as it always has under Windows 10? You can just keep using Windows 10 and it will keep running, but just bear in mind that it may not be the most secure operating system in the world once it runs out of security patches. You can get the extended support from Microsoft. It says purchase, but remember there's also those two free options. If you don't have enough reward points, you can always just share those settings with Microsoft. I mean, personally, I don't have a problem sharing the settings of my operating system with Microsoft. They probably know them anyway, as far as I know. You can certainly do that. Or if you have enough reward points, or you want to go grab a whole bunch of reward points, then you should be able to trade those in. And sometime in the next few weeks, I don't know whether anybody, I noticed Chris said he hadn't heard anything about Windows 10 on his machines.
One person did comment that it just showed up today for her, Natalie. I just double-checked on my last remaining Windows 10 computer right now, and it is still not being offered to me.
Okay, and me too. I checked earlier today, and I've not been offered it yet. There's also that option for zero patch, and if there's anybody else out there who's doing the same thing, just buying a subscription to third-party extended support. And you can certainly just go out and buy a brand new computer, and that will come with Windows 11. And then finally, your old computer, you can just install Linux and play with it. Or you can do what I'm going to do and install Linux as a dual boot system, at least initially. Use Linux most of the time. When you go into Windows to do whatever you need to do, have to do in Windows, turn off networking. So just don't connect the Windows 10 box to the internet. It'll run perfectly fine if it's offline, as long as the app you want doesn't need the internet, which mine doesn't. It runs perfectly fine offline. So trading up to Linux using a dual boot system is going to work fine for all of my machines. I'm happy to do that. I'll run Windows 10 in this extended support process for another year. Why not? They're offering it for free. But if they don't extend that beyond it, then I'm happy just to wave Windows 10 goodbye in terms of main usage, and it will really become a secondary type operation on my particular computers. So we talked about all the pros and cons of Windows 10 end of life options. Lots for you to think about if you haven't already thought about. And certainly, I told you exactly how you can try Linux and use Linux very easily if that's anything that appeals to you. So with that, I'm going to quit and say, any questions?
Yeah, we do have some questions. I'll go in the order that they came into the chat. So AG said, what about security patches? Are they safe enough like those in Windows? I know you did talk about that, but do you want to talk about the efficacy or safety of how you see Linux patches?
Oh, well, Linux patches are just like the software is. The patches are produced by the developers of the kernel. So they're And usually there's lots of people looking at this stuff, and they say that many eyes find problems and things are very secure. I have never had a problem. I've been running Linux now for almost 20 years. I've never had a security issue with Linux. I'm absolutely confident that operating system patches and patches in general and programs that come from repositories are perfectly safe and secure.
That was what I would echo that to as well. AG also said, what about Defender type default antivirus? Is that free too? And is it good like Defender? So perhaps you can speak to, do you really need antivirus? And is it available?
Yeah, a lot of people say you really don't need it. Linux is a pretty secure operating system anyway. Most people run Windows as an administrator, and that gives the hackers the opportunity to do all kinds of things that administrators can do. In Linux, you're not an administrator. You're a regular user, and you have to use a special command to give yourself administration privileges, sudo, super user do command, and you have to give it that password that you entered when you install it. So it's not easy for hackers to do things on Linux. There is antivirus software available. It's kind of in a state of flux. It was called PanAV, and it was running just fine, but I think there have been some ups and downs, and I'm not exactly sure what the status of that is right now. One of the things about Linux is it has a built-in firewall, software firewall. For some reason, when you install Linux, the software firewall is disabled. So you'll find that one of the instructions on my how-to thing is, and the first thing you should do is activate the firewall. And it's really easy to do. It's, again, a graphical user interface, or there's a simple command to activate the firewall. So there's lots of security software available if you need it.
Okay, Jen said, how much computer space do you need? I know you had some slides on that. Do you know what really typical minimum requirement for partitions for setting up Linux?
Yeah. I used to run Windows and Linux on a 60 gig SSD. So clearly you don't need a lot of space. I think the minimum is 16 gigabytes. I'm not absolutely sure about that. You'd have to check. I think 20 gigabytes is lots.
Okay, and I know there are some distributions of Linux that are specifically designed to have a very, very small footprint as well if you really need to.
Yeah, there are some really small versions of Linux, but they don't come with all the bells and whistles either.
Yeah, okay. Timothy says, I have one computer running Windows 10 on a 32-bit machine. Can Linux Mint run on it?
It can, but you have to get the Linux Mint Debian edition, which is available for 32 bits. There are lots of distros, lots and lots of Linux distros, and that's one of the problems. It's sometimes it's really hard to choose which one you should use. However, a lot of them have gone to 64-bit only, so you're a bit more limited if you have a 32-bit machine. But certainly Debian and the Linux Mint Debian edition has 32-bit capability.
Okay. Steve Parker pointed out that you can run it as the live version, install it onto an SSD USB drive instead of a flash drive, and you would get real good speed.
Yes,
that would definitely be an option for sure, or even a hard disk external drive SSD or USB would work as well. So that would be a lot faster than flash. I guess the benefit of a flash is that it's real cheap and easy to do, and it gives you an opportunity to really try it out. It's not really meant for long term, but yeah, I guess if you wanted longer term, you could boot from a external SSD.
Yeah. The reason to use the flash drive is everybody's got one, I'm sure, lying around that they're not doing anything with. So it's really easy to just burn an ISO file to it and at least try it. And you know, the installation takes 20 minutes, so who cares how fast it is?
Yeah. Jen asks, where's the blog you speak of? So perhaps you wanted to. I quickly tried to find your blog. I assume that you meant the Linux North blog.
Yeah, it's so, Linux North. It's
If you want to just stop your share and maybe share your browser or something like that. While you're doing that, Steve was suggesting that perhaps you could give a presentation at some point on important differences between Linux file and drive management and Windows, so we can take that under advisement for a Q&A. Jen says, was there something everyone uses that Linux doesn't provide or offer? So pretty open-ended question on that. I guess it really comes down to the way I replied to her in the chat was that I think for the most part, when you're looking for a particular type of function, you can almost always find a Linux program that will do it, but it will be a different program. And as somebody pointed out, you know, you can't get Adobe Photoshop, you know, in Linux, and you do have the GIMP, but that's, you know, a poor cousin to Photoshop. So that you're going to run into things like that.
Don't know if it's a poor cousin, but
well, a lot of the functions, like the advanced functions in Photoshop, yeah, I mean the GIMP is not doing it. But anyway, we won't argue to that point.
I don't know. I only use GIMP for very simple things. All right, there's a bunch of questions there. I don't know if I got them all in order. And here is my Linux North blog. It's linuxnorth.wordpress.com, and this is the current page. And you'll see that I've actually been posting my newsletter articles as a series. So if you want to know how to trade up to Linux, start at part one down there on the right-hand side and just go through the whole thing. And everything I talked about tonight is in there in quite a lot of detail.
And I can attest to the fact that Alan's articles are very, very clear and very, very methodical about it. So it really steps you through from, you know, the very basics of it to more advanced functionality and things like that. So if you're thinking about Linux, very, very good idea to read all 10 parts of Alan's articles on that.
What was the second question we had there?
It's just Steve Parker was suggesting that you give a presentation on differences between Linux file and drive management and Windows. So I think we can take that up under Q&A.
There is no difference. What you do is, what I do is I create a data partition on my hard drive. So all of my data files, all of my documents, all of my spreadsheets, all of my images that I'm editing, they're all on this data drive, on a data partition. So in Windows, that data partition shows up as drive D.
Yeah.
Drive C is the operating system and all the applications. Drive D is my data files.
Yeah. That's a really good idea. That's a really good idea that you can point to it from either operating system, but it is not the default if you set up a Linux computer. So maybe at some point at Q&A or something, we could talk a little bit about the user structure and things like that that is there by default in Linux. But anyway, it's definitely not going to be covered here, so maybe we can think about that for Q&A.
I see what we're talking about. What happens in Linux is my data drive shows up as media data disk. So it's got a mount point in Linux. So I'm using exactly the same files in Windows or in Linux. Yeah, so what Steve's talking about, I think, is the Linux file system. It's quite a bit different than the Windows one because it doesn't use drive letters. It uses mount points in basically one big folder. So, yeah, we can talk about that a bit. It's a bit like Android, because Android is essentially a version of Linux. If you ever try to find stuff on your Android phone, you'll see there's a different file system than you see in Windows.
AGS, if Wine can do it, why do you say you need to boot into Windows to run certain very specific software? And I guess that's the stuff that just won't run under Wine, right?
Yeah, I said Wine can run certain Windows programs. It's
yeah.
not them all.
Yeah, okay. Now I'm going to the live ones now. Could you please say a bit about more about the risks of simply continuing with Windows 10? How are these risk threats appear if most of the PC's use is while not connected to the Internet?
Then there's no problem. If you're not connected to the Internet, I don't think you have to worry about it.
Yeah.
If you're on the internet and the hackers can find a way in, they probably will.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. So it's a little bit of an unknown, right? I mean, that's the problem, is it's a little bit unknown. If you do have a connection to the internet, you know, the threat, you don't know what the threats are until they're realized.
Right. But we've all read about these huge number of bots all over the world that have been running for denial of service and that kind of thing. Those are people's computers that have been hacked. I don't want mine to be one of them.
Yeah. RS says, Windows 10 had a terrible time setting up Outlook. Any feedback on how Windows 11 Outlook set up? I would guess that setting up Outlook under Windows 11 is going to be identical to the way you have to set it up under Windows 10. So I don't think you're going to end up with any difference from the underlying operating system for Outlook itself. Karen asks, does Linux force equipment updates? I'm presuming this is sort of like the idea of Microsoft deciding that you need a certain level of processor for Windows 11 and you need a TPM and things like that. What's your experience on the Linux side where a new version of Linux comes out and all of a sudden it won't run on your hardware?
No, generally distros are backwards compatible. They almost run on anything.
Yeah.
Now, there is that 64-bit, 32-bit thing that, you know, some of the distros have dropped their 32-bit support, but there are very few 32-bit-only machines around these days. And there are still lots of distros that are available to run on that, so it's not really an issue.
Richard Bradford, coming in from Melbourne, says he's using PenPower writing pad for entering Chinese characters. Have not been able to find any driver that runs it under Linux. And I guess you're almost always going to run into those programs that if you happen to depend on it, and it's like your program that you use, that they're not going to write a Linux version of it. So you have to keep Windows around if you do want to be able to run that, but you only run it when you need it. Now, this one, to enter Chinese characters, if you're wanting to enter Chinese characters into every program that you're using, then Linux might not be your best option at that point.
Maybe you should get the Chinese version of Linux.
that could run it, yeah.
Hi, Richard. Good day, mate. I think the problem there is you may have older hardware, too, that's not supported by Linux. It's a problem when you've got exotic hardware. It's like my Windows program. You know, a few hundred people using the program. Nobody's going to develop a Linux version for a small subset like that.
Yeah, Tristan had some comments on Linux Mint. 2 gigabytes RAM minimum, 4 gigabytes recommended. That's way lower than Windows 11. 20 gigabytes of disk space, 100 gigabytes recommended. 1024x768 resolution. So those are the minimums for Linux Mint. And again, if you have hardware that doesn't meet those, there are distributions around there that will run on just about anything. So you can hunt up something that will run on your hardware almost certainly. Jeff says Ubuntu also has 32-bit version available. Allison talks about she's running Windows 11 but using Office 2019, which also says support will end October 14th, 2025. And yeah, that's the case with most of the software that is running, especially under Windows and especially from Microsoft, that they do have an end of life where they're no longer going to supply security patches. And so you have to pay attention to those things. You're better off that than turn blind eye.
How much of a concern is that for something like Microsoft Word?
It could be, actually, because it's so popular, the attackers definitely are looking for vulnerabilities in Word itself. And if they can send you a specially crafted doc file, it's possible to trigger it. And there have been security patches applied, you know, that came out specifically for Office applications. So it's not a non-issue. It's probably much lower than the operating system, but I would not say it's a non-issue. So it's something that should pay attention to.
You should also pay attention to people who are sending you doc files.
Yeah, it could be. Tristan points out that if you want to select from multiple ISOs to boot from, you can use Ventoy, and he pasted in the link to that. So we've talked about that at Q&A before. What about Zoom? Is it available under Linux?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so there's a native Linux package for that. That's great. Question for next week. Windows 10 was released to public on July 29th, 2015. Wondering how long Windows 11 will last. The official word from Microsoft for quite a while now is that they will support operating systems for 10 years. 5 years for mainstream support, and then an additional 5 years where it just gets security patches for it. So that should be still holding on that. If you Google for Windows lifecycle, you will get a Microsoft page that will tell you what the official end date is for Windows 11. Now, they might extend that, but who knows. And they probably are going to do a free upgrade to whatever follows on Windows 11. Hopefully, they won't add onerous hardware requirements on Windows 12 that will mean we're back in the same boat.
And just a note on that, Chris, Linux distributions don't last forever either. Mint is based on Ubuntu, which is based on Debian. Ubuntu has a six-month release cycle, so there's a new version of Ubuntu comes out every 6 months. Every 2 years, and I think it's on the even year, they come out with a long-term support version, which is good for 4 years. And Mint basically follows that. Well, they don't have a strict release time like that. But when they do release long-term support versions, LTS, they are good for 4 years. And there are always new versions coming along. So you're not stuck with this end-of-life nonsense because there's always a new version available.
Okay. Rosemary talks about the idea of, you know, going to something new and having longer life for it, and she talks about some basics and then more advanced. Again, we don't really know what Microsoft is going to do with the next version of Windows and whether they will require AI capabilities built into the chip as well. They're probably more going to just enable certain AI functions if you have capability built into the hardware, but they will continue to allow it to run on hardware that doesn't have that. One thing that, and I hesitate to actually say this because it's a little bit word of mouth that has come around. She mentions that a very fancy computer being an Asus with an Ultra 7 from Intel. Intel's Ultra processors, which are they're all running Lunar Lake as the chipset. They are getting some very bad press about it right now. Apparently, the AMD processors are running rings around Intel right now. And a lot of people, including people like Paul Thurrott, who has been writing about Windows for probably over 30 years, he says that Lunar Lake is garbage, and there are a lot of people experiencing problems with the Core Ultra from Intel, and he is certainly recommending that people look at AMD as opposed to Intel with the Core Ultra. Take that for what it's worth, but you might want to research it a little bit more if you are looking for a new computer before you buy an Intel Core Ultra. Might want to do some research and see if there are enough people that are saying stay away from the Lunar Lake-based Ultras and go with an AMD processor instead. Let's see. What else we got here? Steve saying he used an SSD USB with Linux instead of the default dual boot drive. So that's another way of doing it for sure. That's not a bad way necessarily. If curious, see the distro family tree. Tristan has a family tree of Linux distributions. He's got a link to that. When is end of life for x86 processors? X86 is the architecture, and that'll be around for a long time. So all the Intel processors now are x86, and the AMD processors are x86. So that's the architecture. If you're talking about 16-bit versus 32-bit, that's a little different. And 16-bit really is going away. There's an awful lot of programs now that it's 32-bit versions of the programs are all that's coming out. They won't run on a 64-bit compiled for 64-bit. They won't run on a 32-bit version of Windows or Linux. So I think that that's really going the way of the dodo bird on that. Rosemary says super heads up on Lunar Lake. Read up on it. Right now, if I was buying something, I would buy AMD. And in actual fact, the last laptop that I have is an AMD processor, but that was before I learned about the problems with Lunar Lake. And so, yeah, it's a lot of people seem to be talking about it. Intel is really struggling right now. Have the issues with the latest Win 11 update been resolved? No, not to my knowledge. Now, the word out about that is that it seems to be a really, really rare problem. The problem for anybody who doesn't know about it is that it can knock out SSDs that are using certain controllers. And some people are saying it's more than one manufacturer's controller. Some people are saying different things happen. Some people are saying that the SSD will come back if you actually power cycle completely, rather than just doing it as a reboot, but you power cycle, take out the power, and repower it, and the SSD will come back. Some people are saying it only happens when you transfer large amounts, like we're talking 50 gigabytes, in a single file transfer type thing, that it occurs. But under all circumstances, it seems to be that it's really rare. And some people are saying, including, Dave Plummer, yeah. Dave Plummer is actually suggesting that you might want to actually uninstall the update that is reputed to cause the problem. And then pause updates for as long as you can, which is a maximum of 5 weeks, and then wait and see whether word comes out as to whether it's been fixed or not. Now, if you pause updates, that's one thing you can do, and it will prevent that from getting reinstalled. But keep in mind that you're looking at something that is everybody is saying is a really rare occurrence, and instead you're accepting the fact that you're not going to get security patches for other things that are known issues that may be more likely to come and bite you. So my personal opinion on that is let the update happen. And even some of the people that are crying wolf on this one, saying that, you know, wow, this is really a problem, a lot of them are actually still saying, go ahead and do the updates. It's a rare problem, but it's something that needs to be addressed. Microsoft says they can't reproduce it. The company that was first pointed to for the SSD in question with the specific controller says that they can't reproduce it. They're not saying it's not a problem. It's just they haven't been able to reproduce it, and therefore they can't fix what they can't reproduce. And so my understanding is, as of today, it still is an issue that they have not found the solution to that. I think it's a rare enough occurrence that you're better off to get your regular security updates that are coming out on an ongoing basis than to worry about this possibility of a problem. So that's my personal opinion on that, but take it for what it's worth. Natalie says, so best to wait to upgrade to Windows 11 for a few weeks to see how this unfolds. No, it's in the patch for Windows 11. So it's in Windows 11 that people are having the problem. I don't know if it affects Windows 10 as well. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if it's actually affecting Windows 10 computers as well. It's just, it's a rare enough problem that, you know, how many people are being affected, and then out of that number of people, how many are still running Windows 10? You know, so it's probably, you know, it's a subset of a very small number of people are being affected. So I wouldn't think that necessarily that staying on Windows 10 is going to protect you from that. Especially if it really is at the controller level on the SSD itself, but you know, it's interacting somehow with Windows. So I can't say that there's any magic answer to that. I have not heard anything one way or the other, whether it has affected any Windows 10 users or it's only Windows 11 users. I don't know. But personally, I think it's rare enough that, I would go ahead and just continue on your computing as normal. But Dave Plummer, you know, he's advising people to actually pause Windows updates. So he knows more about Windows than I ever will. He wrote the original Task Manager, and he worked for Microsoft for quite a few years. So he knows a lot of the ins and outs of Windows. He's not screaming that, oh, the sky is falling. But he's just saying, well, play it safe. You know, pause the updates. But playing safe by pausing updates means you're not getting other security updates. So take that for what it's worth. And B says, my computer wants to do an update tonight. I have 22H2. Yeah, that's the latest version of Windows 10. And so personally, I would say do an image backup of your computer just for safety, and then go ahead and do the update. At the next Q&A next week, I will have a share on a computer that I tried to do an update, and it failed, and it rolled back quite nicely to Windows 10. But it was something that Microsoft said was compatible with Windows 11. It was green check marks right across the board. But when I did it a couple of hours later, it just rebooted into Windows 10. There are still some issues, but I would say do an image backup just for safety's sake, and then go ahead and do the update to Windows 11. That would be my advice. And if I had any Windows 10 computers left that still ran, that were capable of going to Windows 11, that's what I would do. Steve Parker says, today's 22H2 update worked fine. I presume you mean Steve. Oh, actually, I should unmute people, so hang on a second. Where am I here? Mute all. I can't unmute people. What I can do is mute all and give you the ability to unmute yourself. So, Alan, you'll have to do that. So everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves right now. Steve, I assume that you're talking about the 22H2. That's the Patch Tuesday update that came out?
Yeah, that's right, today.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I got
that. Are you suggesting that we don't do it, that I have to do a backup before I do it?
Well, most people don't. I just think it's prudent to do an image backup beforehand so that if anything goes south in the middle of the update, you can always recover to the state you were in. So okay. I think it's always prudent. But, I mean, you know, there's tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people who have done the update from Windows 10 to Windows 11 with that incident. So.
Okay, so but that's just the regular US easy whatever.
Yeah, easy us to do backup if you use that. Do a full backup using that, and then do your update.
Okay.
Yeah, I have mine set to do a backup every 8 o'clock every day.
Yeah.
Well, then if anything gets screwed up, like the updates or whatever, I just revert back to what I had 8 o'clock this morning.
Yep. Yeah, and I mean, just because of the nature of it, I personally would just do a new full backup just before you do the upgrade to Windows 11.
And there, was way, a new there was a new NVIDIA card update today at the same time, too.
Yeah, they come out with updates every month.
It's more like every week or so now.
Oh no, they're almost always on a monthly schedule for NVIDIA drivers, at least on the studio drivers. I don't go with the game ready drivers. They tend to be a little bit more.
Yeah, I go with the gamer one because they come out first.
Yeah, they do come out first, and I always figure, well, I don't mind being a little bit behind the rest of them, and so I go with the studio drivers, and I'm not quite as worried about some bug creeping in that hits on the game-ready drivers. They fix it and then do it right on the studio drivers. I don't need to be that current on my video drivers. They still come out once a month for the studio drivers, so I'm quite happy with that.
Noticed that too. You know the Ask Leo videos that have been out now, and
yep.
It's got the he's got an NVIDIA card box on the shelf behind him. I looked up how much that card cost on Amazon. You want to take a guess at it?
I would guess 10,000.
Okay, well, you're double that. It was just over 5,000.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, some of the ones, that they've got like 24 gigabytes of RAM on the video card and things like that. It's outrageous what they put onto those. Gamers will spend any amount of money to get an advantage.
Well, it's not just gamers, like the engineering ones, like the Quadro Pro cards. I mean, those aren't for gamers. But for if you're designing airplane parts and things for Boeing 747, you definitely need the $10,000 video cards and up.
Yeah. Bob Harris asked, if somebody cannot do an image backup, is a restore point worthwhile? Personally, I would say no.
No.
Restore point is really only if you have a particular problem with a driver, is usually what restore points will actually let you recover from a bad driver. And that's it. It's not going to let you recover your whole system. If you're in the middle of an upgrade from Windows 10 to Windows 11, all of a sudden your computer turns over and dies, restore point is not going to get you back from that. It is really look at it as just if you have a bad driver gets installed, restore points can often let you recover from that, or sometimes let you recover from that. That's about it. So
yeah,
it's not
basically
help you
takes
there.
Basically takes a snapshot of your registry settings.
Yeah, plus it will do
a few extra files and stuff.
Yeah, the files are related to drivers and things like that. It'll recover those. But yeah,
and I've noticed it takes longer to restore from a restore point than it does to restore from your Mac and backup. So it's like restore thing completely useless.
Well, for people who don't do backups, it'll give you something.
Trouble, though. It creates a false sense of security. They think, oh, I've got a restore point. If anything happens, just go back to that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's, yeah. Like
they're
all
the sort of people
that...
You
have to know what it'll do for you or against you.
Yeah, people that use that would be the sort that would wait until after something goes wrong to decide they should have done a backup.
Yeah.